The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Well, welcome back to the Curbsiders Teach Season 6, our series for health professions educators. I'm Dr. Molly Hoyblein, joined by my co-host, Dr. Mike Cheng. On today's episode, we will review some of the top hits from Seattle's AIM Week 26 as a recap episode with our guests, Dr. Rini Abraham, Brian Brown, Stephanie Brown, and Matthew Clark. Before we get started with that, Mike, will you remind the audience what we do on this show?
Sure, Molly. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have such a great conversation today as we're joined by incredible guests in person to reflect on the amazing conference, AIM Week 2026. And we're here at the conference, and our guests are ready to share pearls from their favorite workshops and other sessions.
We are excited to bring you this season of Curbsiders Teach with the support of and in partnership with the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine. And a reminder that most episodes are available for CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. Thank you to all of our Patreon members. If you love the Curbsiders family content and haven't yet joined, please consider supporting us in continuing to create this amazing resource. So without further ado, let's get to it. Well, Dr. Brian Brown, we'll start with you. Is it okay if we call you Brian today?
Sure, that's fine.
Perfect. Could you share just a quick bio about yourself professionally and a little bit personally outside of medicine?
Sure. So my name is Brian Brown. I'm the Associate Program Director for the University of Hawaii Primary Care Internal Medicine Residency Program, and I am also the Director of the Center for Learning Innovation, which focuses on faculty development and medical education scholarship in Hawaii. I am a primary care physician, and outside of work, I am the dad of now two kids as of 2 months ago, and I also play the mandolin.
Well, congratulations on the new baby. Impressive that you can make it over here.
Brian, we'll get into the nitty-gritty about workshop and sessions that you attended soon, but before that deep dive, we'd love to hear how your experience has been at AIM Week broadly. What has surprised you? Any takeaways that you had thus far?
Yeah, as always, it's been really rewarding. I think for me, especially now being far-flung out in Hawaii, reconnecting with my network of alumni and former mentors from the East Coast and elsewhere is always really rewarding for me. I also think sometimes in our own programs, we are in a small bubble and we forget that a lot of other places may be going through similar things and have unique solutions. So it's always helpful to get that perspective.
Well, thank you so much for being here. Dr. Stephanie Brown, can we call you Stephanie for this episode?
Yes, of course.
So same question, can you introduce yourself briefly, both professionally as well as personally?
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Stephanie Brown. I am an associate professor of internal medicine and pediatrics at the University of Miami. I'm the internal medicine program director and the division chief for internal medicine and pediatrics, or MedPeds. I am also a member of the ACGME Internal Medicine Review Committee, as well as the AVIM General Internal Medicine Board. In my professional life, I'm mostly primary care, but do a few weeks of wards just so I can experience what my trainees experience. And in my personal life, I'm the dog mom to a geriatric but very cute dog, who went into secondary heart block, but that's an aside, when he got his cataract surgery. And I do pottery, and that's a huge part of my wellness and my self-care program. I do pottery every weekend.
Great. And same question for you. How has AIM Week been for you broadly?
Yeah, it's been wonderful. I've been a program director now for almost 20 years, or over 20 years, actually. And I'm always amazed that every time I come back, I learn something new or gain a new skill set, and always walk away with at least like 20 or 30 new things that I want to do within the program.
And that's amazing that you've been the program director for that long. I feel like there are often sessions here about how the careers of program directors are shrinking. And so if you have any pearls, please share. Dr. Rini Abraham, do you mind if we call you Rini today?
Please do.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you for joining us. Do you mind sharing just a little bit about yourself, both personally and professionally?
Yeah, so I am the Associate Vice Chair of Undergraduate Medical Education in the Department of Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern in Dallas, Texas. I work as an academic hospitalist. I also work in the palliative care clinic at our county safety net hospital, Parkland. I love medical education, and in particular, I'm really passionate about UME to GME transitions and communication. A little bit about life outside of work. I am the mother of two kids, and I'm a foodie, and unfortunately, my children are following suit. And so my almost 13-year-old has really developed a penchant for sushi, and it's bankrupting us.
But I have two kids, two boys, and the older one is a foodie, and the younger one will only eat like mac and cheese and fries. So I kind of think that having a foodie is better because they actually eat real food. But yeah, he would be like four and he'd be like, I want to order the oysters off the adult menu. And the waitress would be like, you sure you don't want the hamburger? And he's like, no.
We might have the same kid because my youngest is also, she is pretty picky and pretty much just likes carbs and cheese. A good quote in our house is not everything has to taste like a donut.
Love it. Yeah, any main kind of reactions to the conference so far? Any surprises or general feeling that you have?
Yeah, I mean, the conference has been amazing. You know, the Alliance is truly my academic home, and so many of the people here are just, I really consider them family. So it's really been fun to see everybody. I think what I also love is how it brings so many leaders and innovation. And so love talking to people from the AAMC here. So I just think it's a great space for all of that innovation to just really thrive. I think what has surprised me is the weather. Like, Seattle has been absolutely amazing. And so it's just been fantastic.
Amazing. And I think we really did a good job with the geographic variety here today. We got Hawaii to Florida to Texas to San Francisco. So.
Dr. Matthew Clark, is it okay if we call you Matthew for this recording?
Yes, of course.
Well, great to meet you. Can you introduce yourself as well, so both professionally as well as personally?
Yep. So I'm Matt Clark. I'm an associate program director for the Internal Medicine Residency Program at May Medical Center in Portland, Maine, where I also work clinically as a hospitalist physician. I love med ed like everybody else here, and I love working with trainees at the bedside, trainees of all levels. Outside of the hospital, I also have two kids, a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, so I'm in the thick of it. They are very energetic. And we love exploring all things in our beautiful state of Maine. And I subject them to my amateur attempts at being an Italian cook.
My two nephews are around that age, so I definitely relate to the amount of energy that they have. How's your time here been at the conference?
I echo everything that everyone else has said. It's been an amazing experience, as it always is at AIM Week. I have three reflections to share. So number one, AI in medicine and med-ed is here to stay. And it's our obligation as educators and clinicians to guide our patients and our trainees to use it appropriately and harness its power. Number two, we live in uncertain times, and it's often distressing to us and to our trainees and to our patients. And though we don't have all the answers or know how best to navigate this with our learners, it's nice to be here with everybody and share space and recognize that we all feel the same things, struggle with the same things. And then finally, Seattle's espresso scene is outrageous.
Any favorite coffee shop you've been to here?
Monorail Espresso was really excellent.
Great.
Amazing. Well, yes, we absolutely felt the strong AI presence. And I know we'll cover one workshop here, but we also just sat down earlier today with a few presenters who were doing workshops on AI. So, yeah, I think definitely something that's still in process and something that we'll keep building on. But to get started in covering the workshops today, Stephanie and Rini, I know you had some reflections about the plenary with Dr. Ray Bignall. Do you see what I see? 5 lessons I've learned about mentorship as a Black man in a white coat. And we have had Dr. Bignall previously on the podcast and just absolutely love his teaching and message, and would love to hear your reflections on that plenary.
Yeah. I guess I can start and then I'll throw it to Rini. I think one of the first things I took away was one of the first sort of lessons that he talked about is that we as mentors need to mentor towards an unseen future for our trainees. And the example he gave is that our first mentors are often our parents, and they're mentoring towards, they don't know what necessarily what future we're going to have, or even where we're going to go, or what our, you know, what our point A to point B will be, but mentor us nonetheless. So I think that as mentors, we need to really mentor trainees towards their own vision and their own career and guide them there, and not mentor them to what we imagine for them, but what they imagine for themselves. And I think that was the first thing. And we need to mentor and center around the trainees' growth and not our own assumptions about their potential.
Yes. I also that lesson, which was like lesson number two, about not centering yourself, but centering your mentee, I thought really resonated so well. Because I think sometimes the challenge when you're mentoring, and he talked a little bit about that, is that you often feel like you need to be it all for that person, or you need to have all the skills, but it's not about me. It's about you. And so really, I think that was helpful when thinking about imposter syndrome and not being a mentor, but also just reminding us of what we need to do and in the intentionality. I also really loved the analogy he used about the room when he talked about the differences between mentorship, sponsorship, and coaching. He talked about how mentorship is pointing out the door in the room that you didn't know existed, how sponsorship advocates for you in a room that you're not a part of, and how coaching gives you those skills that you need to perform the best in the rooms that you are. So I just thought that was such a great analogy. And then he had a fourth lesson, which is like benefit of learning from your mentee. And he shared a story about moral injury and how burnout is not really about doing more yoga, but it's really about moral injury. And then he shared a quote when talking about that, about how we must not abandon our values out of fear of those who do not share our values. And I thought that was just so excellent, just to remind us that we need to be consistently rooted in our values.
He cited a JAMA article, and one of them was called The World Traveler, somebody that's too busy with leadership and lectures and all of the things they need to do to show up for mentees, and how important it is to be present. And that sort of dovetails with the other one, which is the bottleneck, where you're a bottleneck in your mentee's progress because you don't prioritize them with all of the competing priorities in your life, the meetings and the committees and the vision and all of those other things. So great mentorship doesn't have to look like you, as you said, or where you came from. It just needs to have the mentee's best interest at heart. And part of that is centering them and prioritizing them in the same way that you prioritize everything else you need to do. And really, really, again, showing up for them and being there when they need you.
Yeah, that he had a lesson number five about the long run that I thought was really good. And I feel like the two things I took away from that was, again, I don't need to be perfect. So it's really about being supportive and responsive. And so I thought that was really good, because sometimes I tend to wait because I don't have the perfect answer. But just like, oh, thank you for checking in. You know, just want you to know I'm here. I can check back in with you later. And just the importance of that trust that you build, and how that just like really can help build a mentorship relationship. I thought that was great.
Thanks for those reflections. I was kind of, my mind kind of honed in on when you were talking about imposter syndrome and how that can maybe feel a little overwhelming as, you know, the sole mentor for someone. But mentorship is a whole network. So I think it's a great reminder. And I know that you all mentioned that quote, we must not abandon our values out of fear of those who do not share our values. And I think that really leads into, I know, Matthew, you attended this workshop about leading and mentoring in moral distress. Obviously, quite a relevant topic given the times. But Wanted to ask if you can share a little bit more about that one.
Absolutely. So I attended the workshop, like you said, was titled Leading and Mentoring in Moral Distress. The presenters were Drs. Anna Maria Coronada, Dr. Valerie Gobo, Dr. Carolyn Olt, and Dr. Shana Zucker, all of whom were from University of Pittsburgh. And I believe they were all clinical education fellows, which made it extra great. And this is really important to me because I talk about this with my trainees, and I find that we don't often have a shared language to discuss these things, these transgressions that are happening every single day that people are going home with. I mean, I think it's really important when we think about burnout. So these are things that were explored during the workshop, and that's what drew me towards it. So I have some takeaways. So the first takeaway is a common shared language that the speakers shared with us. And I think this is something that you all can bring back to your teams, right? So on the wards and the clinics, wherever you are in the office. And they really defined this concept of moral distress, moral injury, and then burnout, and those entities being on sort of a continuum with each other. So moral distress, they defined, actually originally came from like the military literature, I believe. Andrew Jameson was the person who coined the term, but they defined it as moral distress arises when one knows the right thing to do, but institutional constraints for one reason or other make it nearly impossible to pursue the right course. So they describe moral distress as sort of an episodic event, something that we might experience on the wards or in the clinics on a day-to-day basis. Moral injury, however, is repeatedly bearing witness to episodes of moral distress. So it's a more persistent sensation. And if this continues in the long term, it may lead to end stages, which will culminate in burnout. There's lots of sort of definitions of burnout, but one that they offered that I think is valuable here is burnout is a syndrome of emotional exhaustion, loss of meaning, and a sense of ineffectiveness. And really differentiating on that framework, that continuum of moral distress to burnout is sort of this concept of a loss of emotional engagement. So if you're experiencing moral distress, you're still emotionally engaged, you're handling that, right, in one way or another. But if you're burnt out, you're numb to that, you've lost that emotional engagement. So that's really the differentiation, the inflection point. So that's sort of the common shared language, I think, is a good starting place to talk about and unpack these concepts with your team. And then the second sort of hot take that I have is whatever we're experiencing as educators or more senior clinicians, you have to remember that your trainees, especially the more junior they are experiencing those emotions in amplification, right? And they're more susceptible to moving up the continuum towards moral distress. And they actually quoted a study of brand new third-year medical students on the wards after an episode of moral distress. And they did structured interviews. And the themes that came up over and over again were the concepts of powerlessness, failure, guilt, isolation, shame. So all these sort of deep-seated emotions that are really associated or symptoms of really moral distress more than even just an isolated episode of injury. And so that just sort of shows that our junior learners are more susceptible to moving up that continuum. And really, ultimately, this is a threat to intrinsic self-motivation. And that's really important for our wellness, right? So the next key point is there are three components that are key for self-motivation according to self-determination theory. And this is autonomy, competence, and relatedness to our teams. And when those are threatened, our wellness is threatened. And so the next point, the last point, is sort of a practical and kind of simple framework to try and address these episodes and to prop up these ideas of autonomy, competence, and relatedness to our teams. And so what they proposed was this model called circle of concern and circle of control. And essentially, this is something that you can use at point of care, just in time, when you perceive that an episode of moral distress has happened. And essentially, it asks the users or the teams to consider two questions. What is concerning me about this? And what's within my influence or control? And so as a team, you define all the things that are concerning you and you put that into your circle of concern. And then as a team, you decide and identify all the things that are within your circle of control or influence and put that in there and name those things. And just by naming those things, it decreases the sense of isolation and increases the relatedness to your team. And it really, as the leader of the team, models competence. So really those three pillars of self-determination, which are important for our wellness. And then so after you've done that exercise, you've differentiated things into the circle of control and the circle of concern, then you take the circle of concern and contain it. Say, yes, these things exist and I'm going to box them up and they're here. And then you shift your focus and act on the things that you can control. So collaborating with your multidisciplinary teams, using your skills like motivational interviewing, things that you can do at the point of care in that moment to give you a sense of control.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing. I feel like this workshop sounds so useful in terms of just naming what you're feeling and having that continuum to really see what you're feeling, but also having those practical tips, those circles, the circle of concern, circle of control, kind of next steps on what to do. So that's great.
And I think it's really hard to do this in practice. Like if you're on busy rounds, right, to make the time and the space to say, let's pause and like unpack what just happened there and use this tool and name these things. It can be really easy to just keep going.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that. It makes me think a lot about kind of training around responding to microaggressions. And I think it's something that without training and without purposeful reflection is much easier to just gloss over rather than actually addressing it. And so kind of having a space to think about it and a framework to try to address it hopefully can let us do a better job in addressing these as educators.
And I'm personally really proud as a mentor because Shayna Zucker, who is one of the speakers, is one of my former trainees. So I'm in residency and she's in fellowship at Pittsburgh. And thank you. Really proud.
Yeah. Well, Stephanie, you had also highlighted another workshop around mentorship. And so just to kind of round out the mentorship discussion, you highlighted designing mentorship networks that work lessons from the mentorship matrix model from UCSF, where Mike and I are from, Rebecca Berman, Lakshmi Santosh, and Dan Wheeler, all physicians. What were kind of your take homes from that and what inspired you from thinking about that mentorship approach?
That was the leadership team in UCSF, internal medicine. You know, they started off really talking about a large mentorship program that they have, and they talked about how they started it. And one of the things, the first thing that struck me was the one of the first slides was talking about how, you know, career interests evolve over time as scholarly interests do. And we often set up when interns come in with a mentor and a mentee, and we set up this dyad, and we don't think about the fact that life is going to transition from there. So really anchoring mentorship into key transitions is kind of important. So the intern starts out really sort of needing belonging and community and really working on their professional identity formation. And as people transition into PGY2, they're more active in scholarship. They're thinking about career development and where they might end up. And then PGY3 is about fellowships and fellowship applications and job applications, and how the mentorship that you need in PGY3 is very different from the mentorship you need in PGY1. And to set up a matrix is really important and go away from that dyad of just mentee, mentor. And I think Dr. Bignall talked about, you know, you have to have more than one mentor. And this was sort of along that same theme, to think about moving away from that dyad and into a matrix where you have your scientific, your scholarly mentors, and then you have peer mentors, which is, I think, something that I don't think about often enough. Your staff can also be mentors in many ways about how you might continue in your professional career. And then senior mentors, you know, your actual seniors, as well as your faculty and your leadership. And then also community mentors, which is something that I didn't think about. Like many trainees have, you know, either a faith affiliation or a community affiliation of some sort, or an activity, a hobby affiliation, like it being in a run club, as an example, might be a way that people get community mentorship. So thinking about really creating a trainee, a matrix around the trainee that includes all of those parts. So, but the important thing is having the trainee in the center and letting them sort of drive the ship as to what they really need, and setting up some frameworks around that. And there are different types of mentors. There are peers, there are chosen mentors, there are assigned mentors, which we often do when people come in because they don't know anybody. And then, like I said, the community mentors. One of the things they had us do was just write down what we had going on, sort of in each phase of life, early PGY1, PGY1 to PGY2, PGY2 to PGY3, and PGY3 end, and then each category, and write what we had and how long that mentorship experience lasted. And I think that's, you know, kind of, again, back to Dr. Bignall's point of having to have continuity in some areas. And one of the first things they recommended doing was really sitting down and finding out from your trainees their needs and doing a needs assessment. And one of the things they talked about was that the things that they thought they were going to hear were actually not what they heard. When they sat down with focus groups to talk about what they had going on and what trainees needed, and they actually really liked some of the things that they had and wanted maybe some changes. For example, they have a mentor-mentee relationship that they set up from the beginning, which they base on somewhat affinity groups. They're usually someone not actually in their scholarly concentration so that they can be a little bit more free about perhaps messing up, so to speak. So it's not someone that their career is dependent on. And the trainees actually really liked, and that's what they thought they were going to hear needed to change. And the trainees said, actually, no, we really like that. What we do want, perhaps, is a better way and a more structured way to offboard if it's not working out. That doesn't make it awkward. And so just putting some time limits around it was, okay, this first mentor that we're going to assign you to will just last a year. And then the trainee can opt to continue it if they want. So, and that's the first thing. Needs assessment, in every form that might be, build in easy ways for trainees to off-ramp and or mentor, I guess, to off-ramp. And then building a mentorship program really over time. Like I think they said it took them to build the whole program, a total of 7 years, and to give yourself time to do that. But you can start with the things you have because we all have something. Start with the thing you had. Get that needs assessment and start to build the things that you need.
I love that. I think that's great. I think one thing that is awesome about it is recognizing the complexity that we are and that we all have different identities. Mm-hmm. Again, hearkening back to like, we don't have to do it all. I've heard people talk about like as a council, your council of leaders that really can help mentor you. I also love like the intentionality of looking at it yourself and being able to like, you know what, I'm actually doing really great in this area, but maybe it's like the community area where I need to identify a mentor. So I think that's such a good framework.
Yeah. For example, I think we do well in pairing people with scholarly mentors. But maybe I didn't even really think about pairing people based on in an affinity group, whether that's faith-based, religion-based, where I went to undergrad, where I grew up, pairing people based on those things.
When it allows like coaching, like more of a coaching role.
Also creates, it helps to sort of start off with an area of commonality where you're bonding.
I made it to this workshop as well and really enjoyed. And I think to achieve that, because I agree, it wasn't on my radar as well, some of these different niches that mentorship could have. One was similar to labeling feedback, labeling mentorship as mentorship so they know it's happening. And then this idea that the mentee has responsibilities, and that includes that the mentee can actually do agenda setting, that they can come saying, my goal for this mentorship relationship is this, and really focus whether that's scholarly versus community versus wellness and these other factors.
Yeah. And I think the other thing was to really normalize that you need to have multiple mentors. And not expect that I'm going to get everything from one person.
Thank you, everyone, so much for sharing about mentorship. I think just a lot of rich content, a lot of rich discussion. And I really like that vision of a matrix, you know, with the trainee at the center, really having that support kind of 360 all around. So really great imagery as well. Proud of our UCSF colleagues.
This episode is sponsored by DDX by Sketchy. Residency programs are responsible for preparing every resident for safe, confident clinical practice. But residents arrive with varying levels of clinical exposure, and it can be challenging to identify gaps in reasoning, communication, and clinical skills before they show up for patient care.
DDX was built to help programs close these gaps earlier. Created by physicians and medical educators, DDX is an AI-enabled clinical readiness platform that gives residents realistic, case-based practice across specialties and competencies. Programs use DDX to standardize case exposure, assess resident performance with rubric-based scoring, and support targeted remediation without adding to faculty workload.
In recent residency pilots, 100% of surveyed residents agreed that DDX delivered realistic, training-relevant cases that strengthened not only their clinical reasoning, but confidence as well. To learn more or start a free trial, visit educators.sketchy.com. That's educators.sketchy.com, or follow the link in the description in the show notes.
Another big theme of many of the workshops you all mentioned was just about teaching in itself. And I'm going to hand it over to Brian to talk about one of the workshops you went to.
Sure. So I attended What Are We Looking At? Tools for Effective Direct Observation of Clinical Skills and Continuity Clinic. And sorry if I butcher any names, but this was by Dr. Channing Brown, Ashley Carpinos, Alexandra Mishkowski, and Sandra Motzios. And so this was kind of a bit just getting back to the basics, which was kind of refreshing in a, I think, a era when we talk a lot about a lot of high tech and new things, just kind of saying in this day and age, how do we get back to the bedside with learners and make sure we're doing that actual direct observation? And really getting at this idea that in the typical clinic precepting context, we very often are taking a lot on trust, even if we go in the room at the end of the visit. So they started by highlighting that med students transitioning into intern year may have very heterogeneous competency in clinical skills, physical exam, communication, and it could be a bit of a black box unless we really go in and observe. And then on the flip side, that our clinical faculty who are teaching our residents may also be really heterogeneous. The idea that unless you're a cardiologist, maybe you're never better at the cardiac exam than when you're a third-year med student, and then you just decline, kind of like bone density, I guess, after that. You just go down. And so, you know, how do we address that? And so I think it was cool because there were points about the teaching side and then also the faculty development side that were addressed in this. And so when thinking about how to get back to the bedside and do more direct observation type of evaluation, you know, talking about concepts like CEXs and EPAs and some of these different things, but generally the idea that we should probably be criterion-based, not normative-based. So actually first what they did, they had us watch a video of a resident doing some counseling and asked us to rate it on this kind of intentionally vague 1 to 9 scale. Of course, the room was very spread. I guess I'm more of a hawk. I gave them a 4 out of 9. Some people were up at 8 and things like that. So really widespread, which is the point, not that anything was right or wrong. And so, you know, what do we do about that? And so they had us think about break into groups and think about creating an observation tool if you were going to implement something. And it very quickly ran into this idea of how granular do you get, but how granularity becomes in conflict with efficiency of the tool and how practical it is in the clinic setting. So for example, there are evidence-based frameworks for the kind of counseling the resident was doing that could have 34 bullet points, 34 possible behaviors that could be observed, but that's probably not practical. And so maybe finding that middle ground. And so on the faculty development side, an interesting point was that whatever form you use, that actually the faculty training, the shared mental model, probably matters than the actual form you use. There's no magic form that's going to create the perfect shared model. There's no workaround for just good faculty development and norming together as a group. And so, again, acknowledging to a group of clinicians who may, you know, feel that, oh, what do I have to learn? I've been doing this for 20 years, and really getting them to open up and re-explore and leaning into people's strengths. So you might identify that some preceptors are better prepared to teach and observe shoulder exam versus knee exam versus cardiac auscultation, and that might be okay also. But there are a bunch of resources you can have, for example, watching a video together like we did in the workshop and then talking about what everyone would rate and why and really coming to that shared model. They did highlight that ACGME has a series of free videos for this very purpose, and some of which they even have examples of what giving the resident feedback on that exact observation would look like also. So kind of on the meta level there. And so, yeah, they had this workflow at the end where you can identify as a group the behaviors involved in that skill. Then you can go compare that to evidence-based frameworks for that skill and then reach the shared mental model that makes sense for your local context. So I just thought it was a refreshing reminder about just getting back to the bedside, doing direct observation and not taking some of those things for granted.
Well, thank you for highlighting that one. I as a teacher, really love the getting back to the basics and having those really practical things. Is there sort of one take home from that that you feel like you can put in practice in the next week or two in your program?
I think on my end, I think because I'm in a primary care residency where this is very important to us, and the nature of our program is that our residents rotate across multiple outpatient sites, both primary care and otherwise. And so I think this will really inspire me to really figure out how to organize those faculty development sessions where we could get together and in a low stakes context, just get the faculty to start norming around some basic behaviors and even decide what skills do we even start with.
Great. And moving on to another kind of core teaching one, Matt, you attended Boards and Beyond, Maximizing Asynchronous Learning for Board Prep and Clinical Reasoning by Dr. Sheena Carley, Morgan Fairweather, and Lisa Schroeder. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
Sure. So I have a couple takeaways from this session. Number one, the ABIM pass rate for internal medicine is declining in its pass rate. And this we've seen since 2021. So to give you some numbers, so in 2020, the pass rate was 93%. And that's where it had hovered 93-94% for about several decades. Since then, so in 2021, it decreased to 88%. We all can acknowledge what happened in that intervening time interval. But unfortunately, the rates have not bounced back. So in 2024, the pass rate was 87%. And over this time, there's about 1,500 more test takers. And so this is also sort of unique to the internal medicine level exam and not seen across other subspecialties given by the ABIM. And so the easy explanation would be sort of COVID, change in our practices, change in our didactics and things like that. But I think it's important to say out loud that if you're a faculty member at a program that's noticed a decrease in your pass rate, you are not alone. This is a national trend that we are seeing, and this doesn't necessarily represent an individual programmatic failure. And I think it's important for people to hear that. Number two, there's not a lot of things that we can use as sort of a crutch to identify learners at risk of failing the ABIM, but there are two that there's a fair amount of evidence for. So that's the in-training exam, the ITE, particularly the strongest signals for PGY2 and PGY3 year, and a little bit of signal for PGY1, and then prior USMLE and or COMLEX failures. And the speakers talked about some other things where there's maybe some association with program size and lower amounts of protected study prep time, but really it's ITE and other board exam pass rates. And they sort of reviewed these well-published sort of normograms that you can use to identify learners at PGY1, PGY2, and PGY3 levels, their percentage likelihood of passing. So the third takeaway is that there are fortunately some evidence-based interventions that we can implement as programs to support our learners if we identify that they might benefit from some help. So some, I'll highlight a few here. So some are intuitive, like giving a structured preparation program starting in the PGY3 year. Another is integrating the ABIM blueprint directly into clinical rotation. So disseminating that to faculty and learners and being more intentional about the learning points there and making sure that they're addressed on the ground as well as in the classrooms. And the most important intervention is a targeted individualized cognitive coaching support program. And this is distinct from resident conferences or academic half day or didactics in general. Those have not been shown to increase the likelihood of passing the ABIM exam. But these individualized cognitive coaching support programs have. And that includes, of course, doing questions and things like that. So then the speakers, the fourth sort of point is there's no right way to do this, but they presented a handful of potential models that they use at their institutions. And one that I'll highlight is Dr. Schroeder at Geisinger highlighted this ACTA, ACTS model that essentially uses a matrix to identify learners at PGY1, PGY2, and PGY3 levels using sort of an amalgamation of the factors that we just talked about, and then setting up sort of these structured sort of advisor meetings every 6 months or so, and employing shared decision making as to whether they should enroll in this program. Incorporating all the factors and the individual factors for the learner. And once someone enrolls in the program, providing some framework around specific coaching that really centers on what has worked well for the learner, what have they struggled with in the past, and developing a unique program for them that works for them.
I don't know about you all, but whenever I hear about standardized testing, there's a wave of panic that comes over me. So I'm glad that this workshop and your explanation of it really talked about some of the evidence-based ways to improve these scores and improve the pass rates too. So, it seems very practical. I know, Rini, that you, on that same topic of teaching in general, you went to this one workshop about from research to rollout, a how-to for deploying AI to grade clerkship simulations in internal medicine. This was given by Drs. Nathan Anderson, Judah Gruen, Andrew Jamison, and Lindsay Stockton. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that one.
Yes. So, I mean, I feel like so many of the workshops I went to, the common denominator was time and how to be more efficient with it and value it. And I think, you know, that's the great promise, right, of AI, is that we're hoping that it can save some time. And, you know, there's just a huge amount of tension that we have in medical education, where we need more objective data to make valid assessments of people. But grading is very time intensive. It's very resource intensive. The inter-rater reliability is poor, especially for the things that we care about as physicians, like those higher, you know, cognitive tasks, like, you know, clinical reasoning and management and dealing with uncertainty, right? Like, those are the things that we really care about. So this was three different institutions where they talked about either how they used a retrospective review on using AI to grade their clinical OSCEs or a prospective review. And so it was very interesting to see, you know, what they found out. So, you know, one of the institutions talked about in their review that the AI, whenever they compared it to the human grader, and it was actually only one human grader. So speaking to the fact that only one human is the only resource they have to grade all of these OSCEs. So it was her versus AI. And when the areas where there was disagreement and then looked back at the disagreement, that history taking and physical exam, actually, there was pretty good agreement. But when looking at communication and interpersonal skills, the AI actually performed worse. And some of that we could think like, okay, robots can't replace us for communication. But honestly, when she delved a little bit deeper, it really was about the rubrics and how the rubrics, what the rubrics commented on and what they were asking for the rubrics to grade on. And so the example that she gave was that the rubric said to look at verbal and nonverbal cues, but the AI was grading on a transcript. Well, you can't look at nonverbal cues by looking at a transcript. So it was really just, you know, lessons learned on whenever we're using AI, like how thoughtful you have to be about the rubric that you used. At the University of Nebraska, in their retrospective review of their grading of the OSCEs, it actually was really interesting that AI won out on the disagreement analysis for every single factor. So, and really just sharing about how much cognitive load there is when you're assessing people, like speaking to what you were talking about, you know, 34 assessment items, like it's just too much. It's too much for anyone to be able to actually do. And especially, and this actually relates to Dr. Brian Kwan's CDIM plenary, when we're doing these tasks, you know, during pajama time, right? So, you know, maybe it's also cognitive load because you're tired. And so that was really interesting from Nebraska. And then the other thing that was true of all three institutions is because they looked at, about AI and whether or not there was a lot of hallucinations. And they found that there actually wasn't. So, you know, something that I think we all are very worried about and concerned about, that was not something they saw in any of their institutions when they ran the analysis. So, there were some things that were quite promising. The thing that they talked about that is the biggest challenge is getting those rubrics right. And so none of these have been rolled into prime time to actually, score and turn it into a grade. Because they're still working. That's what they keep finding is, okay, there's still a problem with their rubric and they still have to take the time and diligence to make that right. So then there were questions about, well, can we use AI to make our rubric better? Like, is that something that we really need to be doing? And then there was also questions about, well, how what about the hot takes of the learners? Like, how's that going to go? And how are they going to feel about AI grading these and when it actually starts counting? It's one thing if you're using it for formative assessment, but it's a different ballgame when you're using it for summative assessment. But very promising. Some of the data they saw, to grade all of these OSCEs, the number of hours it would take is 6 weeks of time for some of these institutions. And so to be able to do it within hours and provide feedback in an efficient way that allows for growth is really exciting.
Yeah, well, thank you for highlighting that one. And I think it does tie in well with Brian's there that maybe we don't need to train the faculty if we can manage to train the AI. But I don't think I'm confident we're not being replaced. But it is. There's so much potential with AI, but still so many questions and so much that hasn't yet been worked out. But I think this will continue to be a really interesting space in medical education. And I think, like I mentioned earlier, we did have the pleasure of sitting down earlier today and recording an episode. So I may come out before or after, but we'll kind of dive a little bit more deeply into the AI space.
I was going to say, I really actually love, I hadn't thought about it, the idea of that it might actually make feedback more timely. That if you can do an OSCE today, you can have, and it's Friday, you can have, by Monday, you can have the feedback for the learners. And so,
yeah.
And we all know that the more timely the feedback, the more impactful it is.
Yes, I was a clerkship director for many years, and we're supposed to grade all of those H&Ps, and sometimes it's like the by the time you get it back to them, like, is it even helpful? Do they even remember this patient anymore? So yeah, it's really tough, and the amount of time that we have as faculty is just it's not unlimited. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, a few of you talked about or highlighted workshops kind of around crafting a career and career satisfaction. So we wanted to highlight a few of those. Brian, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you. So I saw workshop 104, Expanding Career Pathways for Internal Medicine Graduates Preparing for Emerging Healthcare Roles. This was by University of Minnesota folks, Dr. Elizabeth Davis, Dr. Melissa Plesic, Dr. Michael Schnaus, and Dr. Paula Scarda. And I think it was really timely. It's basically noting all the current movements and changes in healthcare, not AI specific, but things like payment transformation, overloaded acute care settings like emergency rooms and hospitals, a desire to shift care to outpatient settings, telemedicine, home-based hospital at home type programs, the push that I've been aware of at my institution of transition of care clinics to get people out of the hospital sooner, and as well as complex care clinics. More data, basically all these changes coming to healthcare that maybe our current residency programs don't as deliberately target as learning objectives and with the competencies we address. So it was really taking a close look at that. How do we prepare residents for the jobs of tomorrow and the healthcare system of tomorrow? And I thought it was really relevant, whether you're more primary care oriented, actually the speakers are more hospitalist focused, what that job will look like, running an APP team. If as a resident, you never do a rotation where you're managing or working alongside APPs, then that's a totally new experience when you become an attending. Even for a specialist, though, after fellowship, you'll actually need these same skills. And so there might even be more of a blind spot for residents heading to specialty fellowship in why do I need to think about some of these things like length of stay and quality metrics and things, but it's coming for them too. So it was sort of a curriculum development brainstorming sort of session where they had us think about, okay, if you had a clean slate, you were starting a new program now with a bit of a blank check, you still had to teach internal medicine, but you really wanted to prepare them for these issues of the next 10 years, what would that look like? So for example, my small breakout group, I think we focused a bit on transitions of care clinic and what that looks like so far at our institutions, if at all. And so people thought about different things. And then from there, thinking about what are the, not only what is the rotation, but the underlying skills or competencies. And I think a big takeaway for me is that it would basically require us to just be very deliberate and thoughtful about some of the quote-unquote soft or harder to reach competencies that sometimes we gloss over a little bit. So things like ICS2 for inter-team communication, things like SBP1 for QI, SBP2 and 3 for some of that larger health system, systems-based health resources, using the team type of issues, as well as PC6, which is like digital health, which will have a lot of new meanings in the coming years. So just getting us to think more deliberately about that. And so, yeah, I think that was the idea, just really having us think about, for our residencies, we might be complacent in the types of rotations and experiences we currently have, but what new rotations or competencies might we need to target for that future?
I love that. We, back in season one, did an episode on management reasoning, and it really helped me shift my focus of feeling like so much of our goal, or at least my goal as an early educator, was to focus on those core clinical, like you need to memorize these skills and understand cardiology. But really, there's so much more that we need to teach people to be successful doctors and healthcare providers. And some of those quote unquote softer skills of like, how do you actually get stuff done in real clinical practice is so important. And there are so many shifting things happening right now in healthcare, as you mentioned. And so, yeah, I think that's amazing to reflect on that and continue to cycle and be mindful of how that's continuing to change and what do our actual graduates need to know. And
definitely. And actually, one additional point they made that I think was really helpful was that if we in GME don't lead this movement, the decisions might be made for us sort of by healthcare administrators. And so if we're at the forefront, aware of these new types of movements and incorporating it in a positive, proactive way, it won't be thrust upon us more externally.
I think instead of maybe already has been, but
I think it's always so interesting to think about the future and to anticipate what could happen, what will happen. I know, Stephanie, you also went to a workshop that kind of similarly or in some ways anticipates what could happen. So you went to the workshop about designing a novel dual leadership model for the 21st century residency. This was from the team at Yale, John Moriarty, Bradley Richards, and Sarita Soares. I was wondering if you can share a little bit more about what they talked about.
Yeah, sure. So this workshop was really about the fact that the job of a program director has morphed from being the clinician and the educator into include several things that are traditionally been C-suite functions, like operations and strategy and budget. And so the first thing they had us do was, as program directors, write down, or program directors, associate program directors, write a list of all the things you do. And this sort of focused on the tasks, right? The tasks that you do as a program director or an associate program director. And one of the first things I noticed was that they gave us a paper with a full sheet, you know, 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with lines, and I didn't have enough lines and had to sort of write on the sides and the margins. And then they asked us to take each of those tasks and put a percentage to them. What percentage of my time do I spend doing these things? And then they gave us a graph and asked us to graph the task. So on the y-axis was how much time it takes. And then the x-axis was from, and this drains my energy or this gives me energy. And you had to write each task in a section on that graph. And then think about, okay, is there a way that I can look at these things that take time or drain energy, take too much time or drain energy, and either delegate them or disperse them or diffuse them amongst my team? And are there things there that I'm doing that are actually really energizing to somebody else? And I had that discussion actually with another program director, not even before I went to this workshop, where he said, I'm a program director, but I'm not into administration. And I said, but that's like the job. And he said, but I'm a big picture thinker. And so my associate program directors really do a lot of that administration. And I think a lot more about big picture. They get energy and they're much better at it than I am. And as I was in this workshop, I reflected on the fact that maybe, honestly, I'm holding on to certain tasks out of control. And also maybe I'm underutilizing my team and things that might actually give them a lot of energy or that they love doing. And I'm holding on to doing them because I think I have to. So that's one of those things that I reflected on and will take away from me with this conference. And one of the things they talked about was using the transitions in your program and or crises as job crafting opportunity and looking at the tasks. So, for example, one of my ABDs is transitioning to a different institution. He got an opportunity, and I think it's wonderful. But then maybe this is an opportunity for us to look at all of what we do and ask people, is there something that I'm doing that you actually would love to do and do more? And how can I utilize, how can I make you happier in your job? I have an MBA, and one of the things we learn is about motivation and a team. And one of the things that motivates people are the things that give them energy and the things that they're passionate about, because that's like an internal reward for them. There are external rewards and bonus and titles and awards, but internal reward is like being able to do the things that you love and are passionate about. And I think I potentially underutilize my team in that way by not letting them do more of that and holding on to the things I think I need to do, which I really don't.
Sounds like an incredible activity for a leadership retreat.
Yeah, exactly.
I can really relate. As a relatively new program, just a couple years in, we just started working and just doing stuff. And then it was a couple years just recently that we said, oh, we got to sit down and actually figure out who's doing what. And that explicit conversation, I think, has been really helpful. So whether you're a new program or maybe in a role for a long time and maybe drifted into things, I think either way could be really helpful.
In those 20 years I've been program director, I've been program director of two different programs, a med peds program, and then I moved into the medicine program. So I think it's also a lesson to realize that you can always learn new things, do things better than you did before. And I think these conferences are a great way to do that.
I love the idea also of like maybe translating that into like a check-in question for a team meeting. Like, what are you doing that's part of your job that's bringing you joy? And what are you doing that's not bringing you joy as a way to just, like, learn? And then also, I think, I'm just thinking as a leadership, too, because there's some things maybe, like, we all don't like, right? And then being very intentional that those are distributed so that it's not just necessarily all on your shoulders, but maybe we can all carry the load because we are a team. And I think even thinking intentionally about the distribution of some of that, I think that's, I love that. That's great.
And I think especially, I love the idea of sort of putting all the tasks in a bowl and saying, okay, which one do you, you know, is there something in there that you really like and you would like to do more of, and having people sort of pick it out. And it may be actually a way for me even to realize that they're doing some things that I've tasks that I've given that I, given to them that I love and that they hate, and maybe they're not empowered enough or comfortable enough to say, you know, I really hate this, I don't want to do this anymore, can you and I think that will be a great way to sort of create a safe space and say, hey, these are the things that we all do, and what are the things you'd like to do less of, what are the things you'd like to do more of.
I always think it's fascinating, like, what people love and what people don't. Like, I think of, you know, like, I have conversations with people about doing laundry, and like, some people are like, oh, I just like love folding it and putting it up, or some people are like, I don't mind like putting it in the washer, but I have no desire to ever put it up. So I feel like it's always fascinating, the people who just like love the order and some people who have no desire for it.
Yeah, I actually like washing the clothes. I hate pretty folding good. Them. Yeah. So if I could, I would just dress out of my dryer every day.
And I think this dovetails quite nicely with the one that you highlighted, Brian. And we actually had an opportunity to sit down with Elisa Sotiel from the Job Crafting for Clinician Educators, Applying Organizational Psychology Strategies to Cultivate Meaning in Work. And she also presented with Elena Cruz and Catherine Gleason. But that will be in a future episode. We'll dive more deeply, but would love to hear just kind of your take-homes from that, and how, in thinking about your take-homes from that, how you reflect on what Stephanie was talking about.
Sure. So first of all, it was a privilege to watch actually Dr. Katie Gillison, as well as an attendee who couldn't make it last minute, Dr. David Vermette, are kind of near peer mentors of mine from way back. So I was familiar with some of their work leading up to this, but then this had a new spin. So it was cool to see the progression of it. So they started with talking about the concept of human flourishing, which is this idea of we're all burnt out about talking about burnout. And so flourishing is a more positive-oriented model that is more than just the absence of burnout. It's a bunch of other constructs that were gleaned from some qualitative research, including some studies where they asked physicians who were thriving, for example, PCPs who were not burnt out and loved their job, what's going on? How are you loving your job? And some of the interesting findings from that world was that it wasn't necessarily that they had a big protected wall between their work life and their home life. It was more of a harmonized, joyful, meaningful integration of the two. So the construct of human flourishing has subcategories of happiness and life satisfaction, mental and physical health, meaning and purpose, character and virtue, and close social relationships, for example. So they kind of reviewed this human flourishing model. And then the thing that was more new was then they took to this organizational psychology concept of job crafting. And job crafting is basically a reflective exercise you can do with your own work. And it kind of relates to what we were just saying that a team might do, but it's more at the individual level. And so within job crafting, you can craft your tasks, you can do relational crafting, and you can do cognitive crafting. So there are these three kinds of crafting. And the task crafting was kind of what we were just talking about and was kind of the most intuitive to me. This is the idea that you write down every little task you're doing in all of your different roles and assess what's giving you joy, what's giving you meaning. Something that was a bit more new and inspiring to me was relational crafting. So they had us write a list of every single type of interpersonal interaction we have in the various aspects of our job. So these could be every type of learner you teach, every type of staff member, colleague, everything. And it was a lot. I couldn't finish during the workshop doing it. And then thinking about which of those are bringing you meaning or joy, and are there some that maybe you could put a little more love and kindness and joy into, right? So maybe, for example, I remember one participant said their SMART goal at the end was that they were going to try to talk to residents about things other than work, and that would make that relationship that already exists more meaningful and joyful. And then the last category was cognitive. The last category was cognitive crafting, which is basically remembering to ask what you see as the purpose of your work and what gives you meaning. What's your why, your primary drivers? So for me, the big takeaway was the relational part. That was kind of the most new for me and kind of doing this more human being first approach to what you spend your energy on.
I mean, as a palliative care doctor, like it's all values driven. I just love that so much. I really wish we had more values curriculum, honestly, and in medical education, because it really relates, honestly, to what Dr. Bignall talked about. It's like it's really keeping our values as our North Star. I think it's so hard with successful people. We can tend to do, and we see the map on like all the things that we need to do to be successful, but it doesn't necessarily align with our values, and hence we have moral distress or we have moral injury. So I just love that values as the North Star. And thank you for transitioning us right back to the beginning. So perfect circle. This has been really great. I think you guys all shared some amazing pearls, and we're just so happy to be here at the conference and be surrounded by so many amazing educators and be able to share ideas across programs and across disciplines and be able to bring this to our listeners as well. So any last take-home points that you'd like to share and or anything that you'd like to plug, a recent paper that you've had or anything that you're working on that you want to put out there into the universe?
I mean, I'll just make a plug for the Alliance just because the workshop I went to that was the AI in clerkship simulation assessments, the way that group, that multi-institutional group was born is honestly someone posting on the listserv and then just having people say, hey, I want to work on this together. So I do think that there's so many opportunities for scholarship and just like putting your name out there and seeing like who else is interested is really... is like just so powerful. So yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'll give another plug to the Alliance. I think one of the things that not only do I learn things, it's also that sense of community, the sense of sort of, and I don't know if it's some of it is might be shared trauma, but there's, you know, the sense of community that I feel in this group of program directors, and the fact that everybody's so willing to share ideas. You walk away from every workshop with a handout and the slides, and this is how I do things. Here's the QR code to get this information. You know, here's my website, and it's lovely. That culture of community is very strong.
And I think all of you being here and volunteering your time shows that as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. It was really great to meet you all and to hear how your experience has been.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders Teach. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for making this season possible. Thanks to Dr. Ira Krishnovskaya, who couldn't be here today but is helping support us, and to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support of this project. Thanks to the team at PodPaste for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Molly Hoibloin.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I've been Dr. Mike Chang. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medical edutainment.